My name's TJ Myhill. I'm an Atlanta attorney, and my practice includes First Amendment issues. I will profess that I am here to talk more about First Amendment things than Assange things, but we certainly will be talking about both things. I'm going to let the rest of my panelists introduce themselves in just a moment, but before we do, I do want to remind you all that we are recording. We are on video recording. So for one thing, really cheer louder. We want to have it sound good.
We want a happy panel.
The video later sounds a lot better if it sounds like you guys are enjoying us. But also, when you do have questions, please wait for the microphone or the recording will be really weird. And if you have any issues with being recorded, just be aware that the camera is actually only looking at us. We're not actually seeing anybody in the audience. So long as you don't walk in front of the camera, and if you have issues with being recorded, you probably aren't doing that anyway. You'll be fine. So with those caveats, I'll
not legal advice.
That's right. Nothing that we're going to say here is legal advice. I am a lawyer, but I am not your lawyer. If you want me to be your lawyer, we'll have a talk, and it will involve checks. But certainly, we're here to talk about legal issues and legal topics. But this is not. This is our opinion. This is our assessment. These are purely our thoughts, and they mean nothing whatsoever in any type of actual authoritative sense. Excuse me. With that, I'll allow my panel to introduce themselves.
Okay. Hi, I'm Gitech, longtime staffer here on this track until I moved off for the heights of being a guest. While TJ is a lawyer, I'm not. I'm a tech researcher, and I've done plenty of work on things associated with a lot of Assange stuff, and I'm a friend of some of the people who worked with Assange on a lot of topics, including two who were with him while he released the Manning leaks, actually in the bunker with him. I've worked with the Pirate Party. I've been head of the U.S. Pirate Party, head of the Pirate Party International, and one of those in the bunker with them was the head of Iceland's Pirate Party at the time, Birgitta Jónsdóttir. So I've got my knowledge is more definitely on the Assange and the aspects of it, as well as quite a lot of First Amendment things from being a journalist, a tech writer, my interactions in that sort of space.
I'm Jairus Khan. I work for the Mozilla Foundation. We make Firefox. I work on the nonprofit end on internet health issues. I'm an organizer, an activist, security hacker guy. I'm looking at this from the perspective of both what does it mean for people who are involved in leaking information, but from an activism point of view, what kind of effect would it have kind of generally on activists and on journalists if they feel like you can go to jail for working with sources or being compelled to release sources. So that's the perspective I'm coming from.
Hi, my name's Cara Chappell. I am the Freedom of Information Coordinator for the Department of Human Services from the City of Virginia Beach. So I come to you from sort of a municipality/governmental aspect. However, I also have a background as a senior litigation paralegal. So I come from a legal and governmental aspect, but I also come from the part of the world that wants to support information for people by the people. So I come from both sides of the fence, so I'm probably going to get in an argument with all these guys tonight. So anyway, welcome, and I hope you enjoy this.
All right, so obviously the topic of the panel is First Amendment and the indictment of Julian Assange. So why is the First Amendment an issue in this indictment in the first place? Well, the biggest concern, of course, is the Espionage Act claims charges against a publisher. And that's where the first argument comes in. But let's talk a little bit about the foundational facts that got us here. So Assange was originally charged with hacking, conspiracy to hack the government computers and steal confidential information. That conspiracy is in itself in and of itself a crime. And charging someone who is actively trying to steal documents is, it's something that doesn't really surprise anyone. What happened next, though, is that several months later, more charges, 17 more charges, were brought against Assange, including Espionage Act charges, primarily for his actions in publishing the documents. So the issue wasn't that he was trying to procure the documents in an improper way. The issue has now become, is just publishing the documents going to be treated as a criminal offense? That's where the big concern comes in from a First Amendment standpoint. First Amendment says we have a freedom of speech. I can say whatever I want. I can write whatever I want. In a journalistic sense, I can publish whatever is newsworthy and publishable. The First Amendment obviously has some limitations. We can't have hate speech. I need more coffee. Thank you.
Hate speech.
We can't have hate speech. We can't incite people to violence. We can't...
true threats.
We can't go further to further criminal activity. We can't share child pornography. We can't share obscenity, whatever obscenity turns out to be at the moment. There are natural limitations on the First Amendment. But those limitations tend to stay away from the newspaper, right? We want the journalists to be able to report truly and openly on things that are of newsworthy interest to the general public. And so the question becomes, if we are treating Assange as a publisher, then are we now punishing publishers for sharing information they receive from their sources? If we're not treating Assange as a publisher, which is the argument the government's trying to make in a lot of the responses, how do we make that line? How do we draw the line between who is and isn't a publisher when 99% of our journalistic content is coming from the web? I mean, I don't even know where you buy a newspaper anymore. I get all my information online. And what I get is not from the Washington Post or the New York Times, it's from all the small bloggers that I'm reading. It's from the podcasters who are commenting. It's from the people who are sharing the information and are then they themselves the journalists. Well, if that's not a journalist, if that's not a journalistic publisher, does the law not apply to them as strictly? So that's the questions that are coming out of this, is how is this going to downstream, in addition to what's going to happen in his case. So with that as sort of the foundational element, I'll just, Ted, since you have more experience in the actual, and I want you to tell us a little bit about what the history of what brought these charges up.
Oh, boy. Okay. So, you know, I've forgotten the actual latest, what's exactly in the latest indictment, the last one, but... originally, we all know Assange set up WikiLeaks in 2005, worked with the founder of another whistleblowing site called Cryptome to set it up. Then had a little bit of a falling out, and Assange kind of took over. And they had their first big thing with a Caribbean bank called Julius Baron, something like that. It's Saturday, it's a con. Yesterday felt like Sunday already, so... Julius Baines or Burns or something. It's that bank. And there was some legal thing, so it didn't go the bank's way. It showed some money laundering and stuff, so from that it went on, and he started trying to solicit some more leaks and to establish himself as a bigger player in the whistleblowing area. It's always a topic he'd fancied. His real father was a very noted Australian activist who's got more prominent in the last couple of years as John. Then he got this big deal in 2010 when he decided to publish almost out of the blue a lot of State Department... internal cables, which are documents from embassy to embassy between internal to the State Department, and also a video from a Apache helicopter gunship. An incident that happened in 2000 and... I want to say 2008, or maybe it was 7, where some Reuters journalists were gunned down during by a firefight involving a pair of gunships. So after that, he released those from Iceland and then went on to Sweden later that year and applied for residency there. Then a few weeks later, just after applying for residency, he was accused of rape by, inappropriate sexual activities by two women within days of each other. And that started became rape charges and started this whole snowball, and we've all kind of heard the rest of the story. And from that, they used the fury of the release of the Manning cables to try and paint the rape allegations in many ways, and that's how things have now been spun as a sort of, they're out to get me, no they're not, they are, they're not. That's the basic story of how we got to where the espionage comes from. So to many people, including Assange, the espionage thing is just, like the rape charges, is just a way to get at him for embarrassing the government, and it's a way that is very hard to defend against. And to others, it's a legitimate use of government resources to investigate the release of sensitive government information. So
who, as far as the release of documents, I mean, I think the biggest question, again, the First Amendment issue is its own question, but I think the biggest question with Assange becomes the leaks themselves, what he's leaking, and more importantly, how he's leaking. So would anyone like to address the idea of those leaked documents and the issues around public disclosure of these confidential documents?
Well, I think I'd like to step back for a minute and say I think that the rape charge is actually what led him to seek asylum over to the other embassy.
Ecuadorian embassy.
The Ecuadorian embassy.
Yes, and no, but yeah.
It's around the same time.
Yeah, okay.
Well, he fled Sweden to the UK, and then Radis's extradition to Sweden became final. Then he suddenly fled to the Ecuadorian embassy.
Okay, because it was my understanding, I could be somewhat incorrect there, but I thought that those two things were somewhat intertwined.
The embassy entry was 2 years after the Swedish claims were made against him, 2 years after that was June of 2012, the leaks were summer of 2010, and he was accused of the rape in August, September of 2010.
So. Okay. So, but he went over then to the Ecuador.
He fled to the UK, claiming he was afraid of US extradition, which is, anybody who knows anything about extradition, well, it is the most bizarre and stupid claim you could ever make. Swedish extradition law is you can't be extradited for political offences at all. So everyone knows about how people avoided the draft for Vietnam by going to Canada. What was the second most popular country to go to? Sweden, because they considered the draft dodging to be a conscientious objector and a political crime, so therefore they refused to extradite. So it was only like 2003 that they that all the people who fled to Sweden were either pardoned or given some kind of citizenship or something to do with dodging the Vietnam draft. But it's because they will not, it is written in the thing that you cannot be extradited for a political crime. Now, the UK, on the other hand, in 2003 signed what's known as an express extradition treaty with the US. So, in most extradition treaties, if I'm remembering my law right, you have to provide evidence of criminal wrongdoing to prove dual criminality. That's a criminal thing in the country you've been extradited from, and as well as the one you're being extradited to. In the US-UK deal, which had a lot of people angry right after it was signed and finalized, you only have to assure the court that such evidence exists. You don't have to actually show it to the court. You just have to assert, swear that it actually exists. So it is, by in all matters, the easiest of countries to extradite to the US from, the UK, whereas Sweden's one of the hardest that can be extradited. So to flee Sweden claiming you're going to be extradited to the US and go to the UK is like leaving the Sheraton and going to the Marriott because you don't like crowds of people.
Let's just say he's made several bad decisions.
Yeah.
But as far as the subject of the documents, so in terms of the issues with leaking confidential information, I mean, obviously the government takes the position that it's confidential for a reason, right? Mm-hmm. These are things we don't want the public to know. Well, of course, the response to that is, why not? What should I know? Is there information that you're trying to hide from us? We're here to provide oversight on the government. That's the people's job. That's what the Constitution allows. But the government needs to function. There has to be some confidentiality in order for certain things to work. We may disagree as to whether our government ought to be spying on people, but it goes without saying that if our government is going to spy on people, they can't then turn around and say to the general public at large in a blast on the news media that we are spying on this person using our three spies here at the table, because then our spying will be very ineffective. We also don't want the other militaries to know all the specifics about our current military equipment. What can it do? How fast can it fly? How high can it go? How thick is that tank armor? Because if we give people all those specifics, it's very easy to reverse engineer something that will defeat it. Whereas if we have that secret, you got to figure it out yourself. So there are things that the government benefits from having secret, and leaking those things can cause problems. Greater problems can come from the things that you are leaking. If we are actively spying, and we three, you know, our four panels of spies up here are identified, not only will we not do our jobs very well, but we will also probably be shot. So it's a question of what should be leaked. And obviously when you're talking about things leaking, it's generally not leaks aren't anything you want. Let's start. Is the idea of leaking documents is we have to leak these things because they aren't being out there. No one thinks they should be out there on the government end. And so the question of the people is, how much do we think we need to see? Do we need to know this information? And that's the teeter-totter of this issue. Okay, Julian Assange is leaking everything he can get his hands on. If he can find anything that was labeled confidential, doesn't matter if it was that day's lunch menu or something from 60 years ago, he's just going to throw it up on WikiLeaks.
Well, let me preface this by saying I don't necessarily think Julian Assange is a good journalist or hacker or even necessarily person, but
he's not.
But he wasn't the person with the clearance who had sworn an oath to protect the data, right? Chelsea Manning had it, other leakers had it. They provided it to him. He encouraged them to give him more leaks, which is a standard practice of journalism. Well, you have someone who's giving you info. You say, please give me more info.
Please give me more info, yes, but I mean, hey, go over there, go get this, go get this exact thing from there.
Right.
That we cannot do.
But that's what I mean.
Well, and that
right?
was the first charge.
Yeah. So that's the line, right? Like journalists have the right to publish classified information under certain conditions. That's what the Pentagon Papers, kind of the law around that showed. And you can say, hey, I would love if you have more information on this if you're a journalist. Where that line is between encouraging a source to give you classified information so you can publish it and saying, please do crimes and here's how to do them and I'm going to give you material support to do them, I think is a bit of a challenge. But I don't think Julian has, any more than any other journalist, an obligation to protect state secrets.
Certainly not those of the country.
Yeah, once they come into
it. Exactly.
He's Australian as well. Most people forget he's Australian. He's not American.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I think we've also
crossed the line.
Across another line. A, we've not established, well, I think it has been established, we have not established whether he is A, a journalist, or be a publisher. So two very different things. And what is the definition of encouraging? Because when you read what was filed against Julian Assange, it's quite interesting in the language that they used.
Well, and so that's an excellent point. That really comes back to that first issue of the government's argument that he's just not a publisher. He's not a journalist. This doesn't apply to him, because the idea of there's no express rule, there's no law, there's nothing in the act itself that says the Espionage Act doesn't apply to journalists who are sharing information. But as a practice, courts have declined to charge journalists. Presidents have wanted to charge newspapers who were leaking information during wartime under the Espionage Act, and the courts have said no, you don't do that. And from that time, it just hasn't been done. It's something that we don't do. We might publish. We might punish the person who stole the information or obtained the information properly and shared it where they shouldn't have. We might take other actions against others involved, but the journalists sharing the information that they received through proper channels has not been subject to the Espionage Act.
Right.
So this now becomes a question of why are we doing it now? And the argument being made back is, well, it's okay because he's not really a journalist.
And he didn't just share it. He also helped trying to steal it.
Well, that's right. Again,
that's a conspiracy, yeah.
And the concern that people who are journalists have is, well, if you're going against him, are you going to go after me? How far is this going to snowball? And the government's response has just been, he's not one of you. He's not. It doesn't apply. Well, the question, of course, is he a journalist? And how do we define journalists? And where do we draw that line? And unfortunately, the real problem with this being the baseline for this discussion, this indictment against Assange, is he's a terrible, terrible party to have in this seat. One of the first things we learn in law school is bad facts make bad law. Because when you have somebody who's just unlikable, it doesn't matter how good your argument is, it doesn't matter how good your legal argument is, the jury doesn't like him. The jury doesn't believe him. The jury's decided that, you know, he's got to be a bad guy, so it's whatever he's saying is probably not true. This is just a bad guy. Many people have their own feelings against Julian Assange. They have nothing to do whatsoever with whether or not he violated the law in terms of how it's drafted and what he did. People just don't like him because he's just not a likable guy. And that makes it easier to point to him and say, well, it's okay, it's just him. It's okay that we're going to take this action, even though it seems to step over lines we've been following for 50 years, 100 years, what, 250 years. It's okay to do it here because, well, he's kind of a dick, right? So it's okay. Nobody's going to care.
Yeah, and well, I think that when you have something like someone, like the Espionage Act, traditionally not being used to charge journalists, when you have someone like Assange, who they might want to use it against, and whether that is or is not legitimate for his case, because maybe he's a journalist, maybe he's a publisher, maybe he encouraged Chelsea, it's precedent now. And now it's a new tool that people can use to, you know, crack down on journalists. And they don't get to be the first one to do it. They don't get to make the new law. It already exists.
It's not precedent yet.
Right, right.
So the thing about the Espionage Act is, in order to really use that as something to go against, press charges on, it must be clear and present danger. Which, as I understand it, and I may not understand this entirely, but it has to be within a period of 7 to 10 months to be clear and present danger. And everything that he published was within two to three years after the fact. So I don't see how the government can actually apply the clear and present danger law to what he published. In fact, so
yeah. In fact, the video, the collateral murder video. Anybody seen it? Yeah, seen it? Okay. It was often put out as exposing a war crime. There's just a slight problem with that. It was actually published, a whole chapter of a whole book was written on it. It was published 5 months before that video came out publicly. Also, Reuters had seen that video 2 years earlier because it was their journalist and U.S. command had shown them that video. So the often claim about it is exposing a war crime when it was very much already exposed. Reuters had written about it 2 months after it happened. And a whole chapter of a book months before they published the video. So it's definitely not going to be a clear and present danger in that aspect because it was something that was already in the public sphere. The existence of the incident and the details around the incident. So,
yeah, and that's something that we need to remember here. When we talk about these foundational questions and what's going to happen next and worrying about Snowball, we haven't even gotten the first flakes, right? I mean, we're having this panel because it raises questions about are there attacks on the First Amendment. Are there First Amendment issues that are coming out of this? Are there concerns about it snowballing? But as of right now, he's been charged. Charged does not mean found guilty of anything. Charged does not mean that anything is final. You can raise charges against anybody for anything. You still have to prove them. You still have to prove that. Right? Yeah, you still have to prove that somebody is guilty of the charges that you have raised against them. And of course, we are innocent until proven guilty. You've got to get proven guilty. So we're not at that stage yet. We're having a conversation about what might happen, but there is no precedent or found guilty aspect yet. It's all still charges.
Right, but if I'm a journalist / publisher, maybe I have my own blog. Maybe I don't publish something now, mm-hmm. right? Maybe because, you know, I don't know how this is going to turn out, but I definitely don't want to be
right.
case number two,
That's
right?
Exactly
so,
right.
like, even if it doesn't set law, what is the chilling effect it has on journalism and on whistleblowing and on kind of exposing mm-hmm. what people feel like are illegitimate uses of government power and secrecy?
So now, I mean, as you can tell from up here, there are a million issues to be mined here, and we have an hour. So obviously, we're not going to touch on every single thing that we could talk about in here. So what I'd like to do is talk about what you guys want us to talk about. And by that, I mean, why don't we open the floor for questions, and let's take some topics that you guys would like to either have questions on or something you'd like more information on. Let's move the panel in the direction that you guys want to hear.
Commander in the front.
Yeah.
Just wait for the
mic to come out. Again, we're recording sound, and if we don't have the box, the question goes away.
Thank you for taking my question. My question goes to the suitability of charging a foreigner, right? You know, take the counterexample. Presidents prior to Trump encouraged the NSA to eavesdrop on Angela Merkel and other foreigners. Would we think it was appropriate if the Germans indicted President Obama and President Bush for breaking their secrecy laws? Yeah. I mean, isn't there a ridiculousness about charging a foreigner in this case?
This goes back to what I said about the extradition treaties. It's a thing called dual criminality. So what's criminal, it has to be a criminal act in both countries. So they couldn't do it because, you know, it may be criminal in Germany for an American to spy on a German chancellor, but it's certainly not criminal for an American NSA officer to use his NSA job to spy on a foreign national. That's literally his job to do it, and so it's not a criminal act in the U.S., so therefore there's no dual criminality. And
okay, thank you.
So that's one of the things that Kim.com's arguing about right now with his extradition to the U.S. from New Zealand, as well as his dual criminality aspects.
Also, let's be perfectly clear. Germany's doing it back. You know, everybody's doing it. You don't want to start poking the guy, because sooner or later somebody's going to start poking back. So there's that aspect too.
But when it comes to that sort of thing, the thing that they tend to do, they find like a spy is what's called a PNG of them, persona non grata of them, and just basically kick them out of the country, flag them, and that's it. If they're locals, you don't charge them, because that just sets off a really nasty war counter war.
Okay, hi. So, I don't know a ton about like the whole situation, but I guess my question right now is, did Assange have anything to do with the leaking of the Clinton emails? Because I feel like at that point he was far removed.
You mean the DNC ones?
Yes.
He he certainly put an index up of them. I believe it was Guccifer who published them. He'd like to claim it's Seth Rich, but the he doesn't claim it. He strongly hints it by the offering of a reward. Although anyone who's read the Mueller report will note that there are several things where apparently Seth Rich must have been a zombie because there were conversations with Assange after Rich had been killed.
Can I ask real quick, who's Seth Rich? Who was Seth Rich?
He was a DNC staffer who was found murdered in DC about the time of the Guccifer leaks, the DNC email leaks, and many info wars and stuff. And Assange kind of hinted that he was the one who leaked them out, and then that the Clintons had him murdered because he was killed all at 4 a.m. in a nice neighborhood in DC, and his wallet was not cleared out completely. Which just may mean he's been disturbed, and his murder's never been solved.
Okay.
So they like to play it as an insider, as not a rather than so Russians or
and
Guccifer.
Then, can I ask the second question, or is that not okay? I can give it away.
You've already asked the second.
I guess so. But so, never mind. I already forgot it.
You can always bug us after the panel too.
So I believe I heard this previously, but you mentioned here there's things that Assange has done that were like he's acting like a journalist or publisher, and then he's not acting like it. What kind of things has he done where, not the personality, but actions he's done where it's not in that journalistic realm that sort of muddies this?
Well, that was the first indictment. There wasn't this much hubbub over the first indictment because the first indictment was conspiracy to steal documents, basically. And what he was doing was not just saying, I mean, as Jerry said, hey, if you have any more of these, I'd love to get them. He said, hey, I want some more of these. Here's how you go get them. Let me help you go get them. Let me, you know, instruct you
on. It was how to, he couldn't hack, was it a Rainbow Table? Yeah. And he wanted help, Assange's help Manning wanted Assange's help in cracking a Rainbow Table to gain same access to where Manning already had access, but using a different username so it wouldn't tie back to Manning.
Yeah, it's like if I was like, I want more classified documents, you're like, the safe is locked, and I'm like, here's a master key.
No, here's the back door. Oh, like that was right. A different panel.
Right.
Today.
Right.
Yeah, we did a backdoor encryption panel yesterday, so all that kind of stuff yesterday. He caught it.
Hi. So the essence of this is the conflict between First Amendment and secrets, government secrets. Mm-hmm. First Amendment was written 1790-ish.
1790,
92. Espionage Act was written 1921, 29, something like
1917,
wasn't it? Yeah. Okay. So since the question now is the secrets of how they're actually disseminated, like technology has changed so much since then, do we just need more tech-savvy legislators? Do we need to actually...
This is where the problem comes in, because every time something new changes with the way the world changes, everybody goes, let's change the law. But every time we change the law, you change the way the framers' intent actually was. And the farther away we get from what the framers' intent was, we change the country. How far do you want to change our country?
What's wrong with just putting an interpretation that fits with the First Amendment?
Well,
it may fit now, but will it fit in 10 years? What I'm saying is, define a light source to me. Define that light back there behind your head. Define it for me. How is that light being generated? I mean, you could say it's just a light and it emits light and therefore it's a light, or it could be, you know, it's an incandescent tungsten wire that gets heated up to 3,500 degrees
and that's the energy level.
So as you get more specific, then as lights change, oh no, that one's an LED, that one's a metal, a carbon arc thing. As you get more specific, then it also is easier to supersede, and you then have to keep redefining every single time.
Well, we're still redefining. It's just judges are doing it as opposed to legislators.
But if you keep it generic, you don't need to keep redefining.
Right. That's the but that is an issue here. One of the things that is a problem with the Espionage Act in general, not just in this case, not just in the First Amendment, but the issue with the Espionage Act in general is it is a broad and blunt instrument. Yeah. It is not finely tuned to anything. It is in itself designed to be, we know it when we see it, right? Just like so many other things. So it is ultimately one problem is that it is broad. But the fact that it is broad allows it to remain useful, because again, if it's, as he said, if it's too narrowly defined, if we try to define publisher, for example, again, there's nothing in the act about that. We just don't use it against publishers, but if we tried to take a page and add it to the Espionage Act and define journalist, well, if we'd have done that in 1917, it would have been, you know, some guy working for a Hearst company. If we were
a newspaper guy, yeah, basically.
If we were going to do that now, well, I don't even know where to buy a newspaper. It's going to be, you know, the guy writing a blog. It's going to be, you know, a couple of people posting to a wiki site or something like that. That's journalism now. And in 10 years, I have no idea what it's going to be. So that's the question. Yes, you can change laws to keep up, and oftentimes our laws do. I know that some of you have been coming to these panels as long as I have, and that means that you've seen me repeatedly talk about how we need somebody in Washington who knows what the fuck they're doing, because all they do is monkey around with stuff they don't understand
at
some lobbyist's behest and end up with something that's worse than we started with. So yes, tech savvy congressman would be awesome, and somebody who really understood what they were doing and the ultimate intent would be awesome. But laws themselves tend to be blunt instruments, because surgical precision doesn't lend itself to
mass use.
You know, maybe the world isn't, the world is chaos, and so we need to be able to cover whatever chaos may bring us.
Okay,
I think the blue guy had a question.
Who's got the box? Okay.
Hi. Do you feel that if he had published the Manning documents by redacting the names of people actively involved in current operations, it would have reduced the charges currently leveled against him? And, you know, how do you define the line of a journalist, since journalists typically do redact the names of people that may or may not be endangered by various secret documents leaked or published?
Let's be very clear. I mean, these documents and the concerns that are being raised are the people being named, because other than those people who are presumably potentially still active in those roles, the information is old. The information is not necessarily stale, but it's not new. There can be much more confidential information in a document than just people's names. If he had redacted these names, would there be charges? Well, I think there's a lot of varying opinions at the table about why the charges were brought in the first place. And so maybe if I'm bringing them to harass him, as he contends, then nope. Doesn't matter what you do. I'm bringing these claims anyway, because I'm bringing them not because I think you've actually violated the law, but because I'm harassing you. If I'm bringing them, even though I know, as Kara suggests, that we can't prove this case, no, because I'm bringing them anyway. If I was actually concerned about the espionage, potentially. So it really comes down to motive of the filing.
I think most of the people who the government has considered using the Espionage Act against in the past are people who, you know, if you look at Woodward, or you look at people who traditionally are publish what's coming from leakers or whistleblowers, when they are about to publish, they go to the government and they're like, here's our story about your terrible classified stuff. If you give us a really good reason, we might change some of it. Maybe. And if the government's like, if you take this one date out, it might save a life. And the journalist might be like, yeah, okay, that's fair. It doesn't affect the story. Or they might be like, no, you're cheating, whatever. And Assange was so aggressively not participating in that process, and so aggressively, I'm publishing everything full transparency, that I think that the kind of social contract that existed between government and journalists or government and publishers, the government's like, well, if he's saying the contract doesn't apply, then the contract doesn't apply, and let's go get him. That's my personal opinion. I think that if they had done things differently, he wouldn't be treated like a foreign agent.
I think his exact words were, F them, they knew what they were getting involved in. About those people that he refused when asked why he didn't redact the names. I believe that's what he said. I may be wrong, but I think it was. F them, they knew what they were getting involved with.
So in the indictment filed against Assange, in one section, there's an area that Assange called it regrettable that sources disclosed by WikiLeaks may face some threat as a result. But in the same interview, Assange insisted that we're not obligated to protect some other people's sources, military sources, or spy organizations' sources, except from unjust retribution. So, I mean, these people are coming forward for whatever purposes that they're doing so on their end, knowing that there may be some sort of retribution, and for whatever purposes. You know, they had their own reasons and justifications.
So my question is, perhaps there's a distinction here between Assange as source and Assange as publisher, because the way people found out about Julian Assange's work was he deliberately went to The Guardian, he deliberately went to German publications, he deliberately went to The New York Times and The Washington Post. So if he then acts as a source, rather than saying, I'm just publishing this, now I'm not going to push this on anybody else, does that create a distinction?
Well, I think aggressively seeking documents doesn't make you a source. Obtaining the documents yourself may make you a source, and if you're doing so in a criminal way, then that's going to cause problems. The source of confidential information is going to either, well, it's got to be one of two sources, either someone who has legitimate access to that confidential information and is sharing it in violation of whatever confidentiality agreement they are under, or it is someone who does not have legitimate access to that information and has acquired it improperly. Both of those are problematic, and that's where the potential issue against the source comes in. The source is doing something that violates at least a contractual, if not other, statutory obligation. And if I sign a confidentiality agreement, I sign an NDA, I get some documents or information, and then I go share it with these guys, well, I have violated my contract with you. I am now liable for my actions. But what they have is no contract with you. What they now have is information that they've obtained without signing a contract that says they won't read it, without signing a contract that says they won't disclose it, without doing anything else. And so that's the distinction between source and journalist or publisher that we were discussing earlier. The problem, the aggressive search for documents is not in and of itself problematic unless your aggressive search includes here's the shovel and here's a map of where to dig. So.
Thanks. That's kind of where I was trying to get to with my last statement, but I think I kind of missed that piece.
Says getting laid into cone.
Okay, over here.
What do you think about the validity of the indictment for conspiracy to hack, since the intent and what it effectively was covering source, which publishers allowed to do? And what do you think that the impact of that? What do you think the impact of how that's going to be ruled is going to be?
Is it really covering a source, though? I mean, covering a source means you don't tell anybody who the source is. It isn't you trying to manufacture evidence to make it to be somebody else. That's not covering a source. That's trying to falsely implicate somebody else, because that's what they were trying to do, was try to engineer it so that it would be somebody else's name attached to it and therefore implicate somebody else as a source. They weren't covering Manning. They were trying to frame somebody else. So that's the other way to look at it, is he was framing somebody, not covering Manning.
Right.
So If I look at that, does that sort of change your question a little bit there?
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't the intent still to cover Manning.
You think
the intent was...
I need funds to publish the information too, but I can't go rob a bank to get those funds. The fact that I have a legitimate need for funds doesn't mean I can get them through an improper means. The issue with the source, again, many journalists won't disclose their source. The way that happens is, hey, Jairus, tell me your source for that last thing.
No.
Okay. But if he goes out and then says, here's a bunch of falsified documents that show it was Ketch, well, now we have an issue. And that's what was coming here. They weren't just erasing Manning's name. They were trying to insert somebody else's name and trying to do it through another criminal act, which was hacking.
Yeah, and I think this is something that is you see systemically through this and a lot of other kind of WikiLeaks controversies, is there's a kind of accepted gray area that journalists working with sources operate in, and he's like, I think we should go a bit further. I think instead of just, trying to figure out how to encourage them, we should give them the shovel. And I think that it's both embarrassing to the government and very questionable ethically. And I think those combinations of things, plus his own personal demeanor, has really put him in a position where I think if any of those things had been different, he might not be.
Has anybody seen the Dragon Con policy that says we do not post bail, right? Everybody's seen people here who've gone that little bit too far with the drinking and kind of passed out and stuff? That's the same
I'm
sort of
I'm feeling attacked.
That's the same sort of thing. Somebody's gone just a little too far, and they're at the stage now where they need bail money because they've gotten too far, too much to drink, and now need to be bailed out. And that's kind of where Assange is in many ways. To provide another wonderful Dragon Con analogy.
Do you think that was the only way that he could have gotten the Manning documents was to use a different credential?
Well, that was. No, Manning had the clearance to do it. Manning had the clearance to do it, but it would also log that it was Manning who accessed the documents and pulled the documents down. The same thing happened with, in Georgia, Reality Winner. I was trying to say Random was running through my head. Reality. Yeah, Reality Winner. Reality's access codes were logged as the ones that accessed the documents in the time frame. So when they got the intercepts identified, they looked who accessed it, and that was the only one who did in the time frame. So they backtracked it to that person, and that's what they were trying to avoid. So, yeah. So they could have got it without it, but it was the only way we could do it and save from being identifying Manning.
Right. I mean, again, remember that as the source, Manning is violating his... I mean, Manning is not... He's under that confidentiality obligation, and by Manning revealing that, he is violating that obligation affirmatively. She is violating that obligation affirmatively, and that is the nexus of a potential, criminal act or other civil liability on Manning, and. Whether or not it then translates onto the publisher or the journalist who's sharing the information, your source still also doesn't want to, go to jail for you. So they're trying to figure out a way to cover that. Sources want to be covered too, but you can't help.
Didn't Manning plead out though?
Well, but I mean, ultimately, would she have had to if she had been able to just get somebody else's name on there, right? I mean, that's the goal. Can Manning go get those documents directly? Yeah. But if I do, I'm putting myself at risk. So that was the impetus to changing the information. It wasn't that the documents weren't otherwise there. It's personal CYA.
So I think one topic that was mentioned was precedence, which seems to be not brought up very much. A lot of this seems to be trying to set some sort of precedent. And also, how much could this just be like you hear on the news where some prosecutor digs too deep into a hole and realizes who they're charging is actually innocent, but they keep going anyway?
Well,
the government's not going to stop this.
Well, you remember at the time, I mean, these charges were filed, was it June?
June of
2019. The original investigation, the grand jury investigation, happened in June of 2010, or thereabouts, the first investigations into it. So it's been 9 years. There was the accidental copy and paste in November of last year into a completely unrelated case that hinted at a thing. That was a assistant ADA that had only started working in that court in 2015. So it's not just one prosecutor. It would have been, you know, an entire series of prosecutors pushing towards it over time. So it and a case as high profile as this, I wouldn't know, not being a legal person, but being more of a journalist, but I don't think one single ADA going rogue at a case this kind of level, this kind of publicity, would be able to get away with just pushing it on their own thing and bringing the whole U.S. Attorney's Office into disrepute. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly right. You hear news about situations where, you know, some local county or city DA will bring charges against somebody that then turns out to be, you know, big news because it was not a good case. These are not the kind of things that have been going on for 6 months and somebody had a personal beef. Somebody does have a personal beef with Assange, but it's the U.S. government. And so, right, and that's, it's not a question of, you know, one person going too far. The question of, again, whether they can prove these claims or not, they're going to pursue them. They are pursuing them. Will they be successful? Well, that's for a judge and a jury to decide, but they're going to push them, you know, or at least push them to where they feel like they need them to go.
I think it's a reasonable assumption that coming out of the Manning trial, they were able to get a lot of evidence that will help them in this trial.
Let's say they're not going to drop them, but they won't prosecute to the extent that they had intended at the inception when they filed the original lawsuit.
Has a federal judge at this point made a determination that the trial can proceed, or is it at that point yet?
To my understanding, it is not going in front of a federal judge right now. It is going in front of a grand jury.
Yeah, it's still in the grand jury stage here, but it's got to go to an extradition hearing in the UK first. And then it's got to go... the US has got to show claim to the court, which is a couple of weeks' time, isn't it? The next extradition hearing, I think, in London. That it's going to... show there's probable cause to that the evidence exists of the charges for extradition, and we'll go from there. Extradition is a very fun aspect of law, and every country has a different extradition treaty with every other country. It's very, very few that have the same law between the same laws 180 odd times.
So, had the information Manning linked not presented a clear and present danger, but all the same steps were still taken, would the case still represent the same kind of precedent? Would the U.S. government still be pursuing it in a similar way?
Well, again, I mean, we're back to the question of why did they bring the claims, the charges in the first place? As I think has been hinted at here, there is some question about whether there is clear and present danger. And again, I think that's an open question. I don't think the answer is clearly no either. I think there's certainly some suggestion that not. But I mean, again, we don't know if these people are active people, if the information, even though it's in a three-year-old document, is still part of an active confidential process. So the question of is there a clear and present danger is something that someone's going to have to decide. But the purposes of bringing the charges is its own question. Again, if you believe Assange's side, he's being punished by the government for
exposing
what they're wrongdoing.
Crimes,
and therefore they were embarrassed, and they're trying to use this to punish him for embarrassing them. And that, I mean, is as potentially true as that there is a clear and present danger. That's what ultimately would have to be determined in finding out whether he was guilty of what he's charged with.
Okay,
do you think that Assange or anyone else will be able to expose the truth about Jeffrey Epstein?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear any of
that. Do you think that Assange or anyone else will be able to expose the truth about Jeffrey Epstein?
Man,
I still
those Clintons.
Yeah.
It's weird. There's
killing
feedback
everybody.
In the mic. I couldn't hear. I said there's feedback in the mic. I couldn't hear anything.
Yeah. So 628, I think, so we
get
one more question.
Yeah, let's go ahead and have one more, and then we'll go ahead and wrap up. I don't actually have my watch, so I assume we're getting close to the end.
Does anybody know what the current status of Julian Assange is? As far as I know, he's still in the UK.
He's in Belmarsh, I think it's Belmarsh, and they often claim he's really sick and really ill, but the last time they claimed that he was really sick, really ill, and then a day or two later, a smuggled cell phone video came out of him in the prison, kind of lapping around, joking with people, and looking just fine. So there's a lot of claims. I'm actually blocked on Twitter by Julian's mother. she wants like to point out that yes, the U.S. is persecuting him, and he didn't. He was told he could leave Sweden, and then I pointed out, yeah, here's the first extradition hearing. In it, his lawyer said. Yeah, we did have this arrangement. The prosecutor did try to contact him, and yeah, he left. And in our applications to the court, in my entire statement to the court, and in everything we told to all these four expert witnesses that said that they never bothered to try anything, yeah, we lied about that. Sorry, that was our lie to try and make us look good. That was just a PR move on our part. And after I pointed out that the lawyer, his own lawyer, said that the whole they didn't try to interview him was a lie. Yeah, she blocked me, strangely enough. There's a lot of narrative in things, so they've been very heavily spinning. So they said, you know, what happened to the cat? He had the cat. The cat had been gone for months by the time he left the embassy, for instance. It'd been gone for months. And in fact, they showed a video on Twitter. I don't think it's the same cat.
That's the conspiracy I want to know about. No.
Where's embassy cat?
What I want to know is, when are the Clintons going to kill that damn cat?
I haven't heard from Sox lately.
All right, well, we're here for, if you have any other questions, come on up and ask us. We can try to answer them quickly, but the panel is over. And please do remember to rate us on the app.
Yep.
I hope we helped you guys get some clarity.
Thank you.
Louder, louder. Thanks.